It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a look at anti-poverty efforts from the White House and leading congressional Republicans.
First, while we may not literally turn green with envy, our bodies do show our emotions in lots of other ways, from puffing up with pride to sweating when we're nervous. Our feelings are kind of there for everyone to see.
And scientists are tracking more ways that our bodies show and feel emotion. Our next guest has written about this. Science writer Gemma Tarlak is associate editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. Gemma, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. It's great to be with you guys again.
Well, I think, Gemma, of emotion as mostly learned. It's like a cultural behavior, at least the way we show it and express it. But in the research you wrote about, scientists found that some of it is built in. How did they figure that out?
That's right. And the study looked at emotional responses in three countries, Finland, Sweden, and Taiwan. And it involved more than 700 people, all different ages, both genders, etc. And over the course of five experiments, they had people view, they didn't tell them, hey, this is going to be a photo of an angry person or this is going to be a sad short story, but they had them view emotionally loaded images, movies, short stories and words, and right along with the images they were seeing, there were two blank body silhouettes. And as the people were viewing the images, they were asked to color in on the computer screen with the silhouettes and one of the body images areas of their body that they felt increased activity. So think of, you know, the way your heart pounds or the way your cheeks flush. And then the second silhouette, they were asked to color in those areas where they felt decreased activity. I think we've all felt, you know, our hands get cold or our feet get cold with fear or anxiety. And then they combined those two images in a composite. And across three different cultures, three very different languages, they found that there were universal responses to emotions.
And there were colors involved, too. Where did the colors come from?
Well, the colors in the chart, and you can go online to Discover Magazine and see it. It's a little tough to describe it here over the air. But basically, areas of increased activity were very vivid yellows and oranges and reds. And areas of decreased activity, you know, the pit in your stomach or the cold hands and feet, those were blues and purples. And when they combine those images to make the composite profiles, it actually looks enough like thermal imagry that we had some readers look at it and say, hey, they're saying this is thermal photography, and it's not. It's just a composite of the self-reported emotional responses.
We've got a visual aid. I have a link to the Discover Magazine article on the Central Time Facebook page, so you can see this in action. Well, let's get into where people in these three different, completely different cultures felt different kinds of emotions. Let's get happy first. What did happiness feel like to these people?
I'm so glad we're getting happy. But happiness, I love it because it's really the only emotion they tested that was felt throughout the body, especially in the chest and in the head, a little bit in the stomach, but really throughout the body. It really kind of pops on that page.
And what about some of the more negative emotions now that we've gotten happy? What about things like anxiety and fear?
Sure. Anxiety really seems to be centered in the chest area. And when you think about, you know, anxiety, you get the pounding heart, the nervousness. That's really a physiological response that I think it's very easy to identify with. And fear had a very similar, again, centered in the chest area, a little bit also more in the pit of the stomach. To me, out of all the images, the most interesting, one of the most interesting was depression.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you look at all 14 images, I should say they tested 13 emotions and had one neutral silhouette that acted as kind of one of the controls in the experiments, but they had 14 images, and depression really stands out because the entire body is this cold, sort of barren blue and purple, and I felt bad just looking at it, you know, but it's really interesting. To me, in addition to the fact that they're universal, they also controlled for specific idioms in the languages. You know, when you think in English, we have the expression, oh, I got cold feet, or, you know, my cheeks flushed red with shame. We have all these expressions that associate colors and feelings with different parts of the body for emotions. And that's in English, but it varies somewhat from language to language. And so even controlling for that, looking at three different languages, Swedish, Finnish, and Chinese, from three different language groups, Germanic, Uralic, and Asian, they were able to say, yeah, these are universal, regardless of any predisposition you might have to feeling an emotion based on an idiom in your native language.
Well, reading this and looking at those images, I'm wanting to feel that emotion and try to track where I feel things and where I don't feel along with that. Did you find yourself, when you looked at this, like constantly self-analyzed, oh, I'm happy. Where is that happy?
Yeah, you know, it did. And I really found anger pretty interesting, too, because when you look at anger, there is a lot of increased activity in the chest and in the head, but also in the hands. I mean, the hands of that silhouette look like they're on fire. And
looks like the Terminator.
Yeah. When you think about the way you feel when you're angry, you know, I feel my cheeks flush, I feel my chest tightened, but I also feel that increased sensation that you just want to take those fists of fury and put them through the wall sometimes.
Another really fascinating one, and I'm cheating, I'm looking at it online right now, is love. And that guy kind of looks like he's on fire, and all of the sensation sort of ends right where you think it will, is from the tip of the head down to, well, you know.
Down to the business.
You know, yeah.
Wait, what about head over heels?
The heels are not involved in this picture, no.
Well, Gemma, I'm wondering why. Are these researchers taking this to the next step and trying to figure out why our bodies feel or don't feel pegged to these different emotions?
Yeah, and this is a really interesting part of the research that, you know, it can be very difficult sometimes for people who are in a certain emotional state or perhaps have a mood disorder such as anxiety or depression. It can be very difficult for them to articulate. You know, I think very few people walk into a doctor's office and say, hey, I'm depressed. You know, it's a process of figuring out, but they think that these maps, understanding how people feel and how people self-report sensations in the bodies linked to certain emotional states, they think this may be a really useful way for someone to, you know, walk into a doctor's office and say, hey, you know, I feel really cold in my hands and my feet or whatever, and just start the conversation that way and maybe, you know, it could be a biomarker that's maybe more relatable for the patient to express how they're feeling and for the health practitioner to say, okay, I think I know what emotional state this person may be in and whether we have to look into whether there's a mood disorder behind this. So it's more information. It enhances our understanding of emotions and how we experience them physiologically.
Do you think that will require a mental shift from people, the idea that these emotions sort of are housed in different areas of the body? Instead of just sort of the mind?
Well, that's a good question and a really big one. I think it really varies. I have to say one of the really fascinating parts about writing about this study was the reader response. It actually was huge online. I think we got more hits than almost any other story we've ever had online for Discover. And reading the comments, it was really fascinating to see how many people reacted with almost anger, saying, hey, this was all self-reported. This is no machines were used. That was my favorite comment. This doesn't mean anything because no machines were used. And I think it's interesting how some people just have kind of a knee-jerk reaction to, whoa, emotions. And I think down the road, this kind of information, the more we have of it, maybe it'll change some minds and put some people in touch with their orange, red, yellow, blue, purple feelings. I don't know.
Well, and the topic of mindfulness is something that people keep coming back to on this show and in things we read out there. It seems like this is a nice kind of target zone for people to be mindful about their emotions, to identify the physical sensations that are associated with them.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, I think that's a great point. And I would love it if we all took a moment to just kind of feel where we're at, literally, in engage our emotional state. I think it would certainly cut down on the number of angry comments on the internet, I think.
Well, Gemma, it's been fun. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Always fun with you guys.
That was Gemma Tarlek, Associate Editor of Discover Magazine.
Coming up, President Obama unveiled a Promise Zone proposal a few hours ago, and which communities will be first in the Promise Zone program. It's a targeted anti-poverty effort in places hit hard by the Great Recession. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Ricker. Today, President Obama expanded his idea of promise zones, something he first mentioned in his 2013 State of the Union address.
The plan is to give 20 areas of the country, hit especially hard by the recession, comprehensive federal funding. President Obama announced the first five today.
Marco Rubio, Republican senator from Florida, also unveiled an anti-poverty plan this week. He wants to give federal funding to the states, who he says are better equipped to deal with regional issues.
Here to break down some of these different approaches to fighting poverty nationwide and put them in context is Ron Haskins. He's senior fellow and co-director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution. Ron, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So we've got these promise zones. This isn't the first time we've seen this kind of focused anti-poverty strategy targeting an area. Can you give us a little background on these geographically based anti-poverty plans?
Right. Several countries have tried this. The U.S. has done it many times in the past. They used to be called enterprise zones and other terms. But the basic idea is, the most important ideas are similar. First of all, that there'd be some kind of tax relief, especially for businesses, hoping that they would be able to locate there or expand there and that they would have some relief from taxes, which would give them a slight advantage. And the hope is that they would either come there or expand and that they would hire more workers so there would be an opportunity for people to work. There might also be relief from regulations, from federal, state, local regulations. A problem with pontificating too much about this now is that we don't really know very many details. There has been research on the enterprise zones and similar approaches in the past, and I think it's fair to call it mixed. It certainly is nothing like a silver bullet. There are criticisms, and there are some research found good outcomes, that there have been increases in employment. So at least to that extent, it worked. The president also intends to build into this several other aspects other than just economic changes and the tax relief and so forth. He wants schools to be involved, and he wants civic organizations to be involved in all these groups, including local businesses, to work together to have a plan for increasing employment, reducing poverty, and making more use of government resources. And that all sounds good, and if it could be done successfully, it would be good, but it's very difficult to do. Let me make one other point about it, and that is there are some elements of this plan that are really quite bipartisan. In fact, I previously thought it to be impossible that you could do anything that would get Rand Paul and Mitch McConnell, these two senators from Kentucky, to actually praise something the president did. And they both did that today because they one of the five zones that was announced today is Kentucky. I think it's a part of eastern Kentucky that's particularly devastated by the recession and even for a longer period than that. So there are some bipartisan parts here, especially the focus on local government and on civic organizations and trying to coordinate business and local government. Those are ideas that Republicans really like. So there are possibilities for some cooperation here.
It seems like one of the core philosophical ideas here is saying poverty relief isn't just about an individual. It isn't finding a person in poverty and connecting them to this program and that program. It's an environmental issue. It's a social issue. We've got to tackle education and job growth and all these other things instead of looking at individuals. Do I have that right? Is that the sense that you're getting from Promise Zones?
No, I think you're exactly right. I think that, in fact, we have a lot of data and studies that show that opportunities vary quite dramatically around the country. I mean, you can imagine, and this goes all the way back to the founding of the War on Poverty, and even before that, to President Kennedy, you may remember, or probably most of your viewers are too young to remember this, but he made a very famous trip to Appalachia and seemed to at least personally discover poverty. He didn't have too much poverty in his background. And there was a lot of attention to areas that are really quite devastated. Employment is a huge problem, declining businesses and so forth. And we have that. You always have that in a capitalist economy. There'll be places that the economy will not be alive and well, and so it's hard for people to get jobs, and poverty is pervasive. So these so-called place-based programs are, on the face of it at least, make a lot of sense. It's trying to get them to work that's very difficult.
Let's look at the places announced today. We've got three urban areas, parts of San Antonio, Texas, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and then you mentioned southeastern Kentucky, more of a rural area, and the Choctaw Nation in Oklahoma. What do you think about the diversity of those hard-hit economic areas?
Well, I think that's a wise thing to do. If I were going to do it, I would start out with as much diversity as possible as well. Especially because I don't think we know from research that this approach is bound to be successful. So try it in as many different places and carefully evaluate it. I think that is really a key here. We need to know whether these things are going to work. This president has been more focused on evidence and trying to base decisions on evidence, starting with the very first inaugural. He said, we're going to expand what works and we're going to cut or try to improve what doesn't work. And that's really a key here. If I were, if I had a chance to quiz the president and his staff, that's the first thing I would ask them. Tell me your plans to figure out if this is working. And that's for two reasons. One is the basic concept of place-based strategies and enterprise zones, or promise zones, as he wants to call them. We need to know if something like that can be made to work, and hence this idea of trying it in as many different places as possible. But the second thing is that it's helpful for people who are trying to implement it to have continual feedback on whether they're being successful, because if they're not, maybe they can adjust and they can improve their performance if they have reliable information. So that, I think, is a key part of this. It's not mentioned in anything that I've seen so far.
Well, it's mind-boggling to me how you would measure something like this. There are so many variables. I mean, yep. An education system, cultural background, crime, whether this factory flips a coin and opens up here or 10 miles away. There's so many variables. How do you start to measure success?
Very difficult. You're exactly right. That's one of the reasons that people are cautious when they read the literature on enterprise zones or promise zones, that, you know, there are so many variables. It's so difficult to measure. And some people would even say it's impossible. There are just too many different things going on. One way to do it, there are two ways that would give you some valuable information, I think. One is to measure over time to see if there are improvements. Does employment go up? Do kids do better in school? Do graduation rates go up? Do young adults, are they more likely to go to school? Are they more likely to go to community colleges? Are they more likely to get a job? So over time, if those things improve, that's circumstantial evidence. It's not necessarily definitive, but it's very useful information. And then the other way is to try to pick out other communities that are similar that don't have the program, and to compare what goes on in the promise zone communities, the five you just mentioned, and others are going to be named over the next year or year and a half, I think, and compare them with other communities that are similar. I hope that the president's people are already trying to pick out communities like that, maybe even more than one, to compare them to see if there are improvements in the promise zones that do not occur in the similar communities.
One of the things the White House made a big point of was saying, hey, these are communities that came to us. We invited these plans, but these communities, mm-hmm. they're government leaders, I think civic leaders, put together plans, and we reviewed them, and we're participating. How important is local leadership, a big local stake in coming up with the Promise Zone plan?
I think it's hugely important, but it's, again, very difficult to do. I've had the opportunity to work with a number of local groups in Buffalo and Norfolk and in other cities, and the people that are trying to pull together, they often represent the schools, and they represent the Department of Social Services, often the mayor's office, and so forth. But it's very difficult to make those groups to work together. The individuals often are leaders in the community, and they do try to work together. But to get these big organizations to pull in the same direction is very difficult. But it has to be tried. In fact, I would go so far as to say that if you don't have local buy-in and they can't make progress in trying to all pull in the same direction, the projects will fail.
And speaking of pulling in different directions, this is, I think, bringing together efforts from five federal departments, education, housing, urban development, and others. How important is that, making sure these bureaucracies are all pointed in the same direction here?
I think it's important, but I think it's less important than the local buy-in. The president presumably has quite a bit of control over the federal agencies. In fact, I've recently been involved in a study where I've interviewed people in not every agency you just mentioned, but several federal agencies. And I have been impressed by the degree to which these agencies work with the Federal Office of Management and Budget, which is really the kind of the budget and operations arm of every president. And that's quite impressive. So I do think that they probably have laid this plan pretty carefully. Many of these agencies have experience with similar programs, and there's at least a chance that they'll be able to work together. But even if they do, the local buy-in and the local coordination is still going to be crucial.
We're talking about federal anti-poverty efforts proposed this week. Promise zones we've been talking about. President Obama gave some details today. And coming up, we'll talk about Senator Marco Rubio calling on something like block grants, letting states make the decisions. Ron Haskins is with us. He's with the Brookings Institution.
And we'd like to know what you think about President Obama's plan to combat poverty and looking ahead at Marco Rubio's plan as well. Do you think it will help? And which approach do you think is going to fit the bill better? 800-642-1234 is the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're speaking now with Ron Haskins, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution.
We're talking about federal anti-poverty efforts. President Obama took the next steps in his Promise Zone plans, announcing the first five of 20 communities that will be declared Promise Zones, get some tax breaks, efforts to boost education, fight crime, among other things in those areas. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Marco Rubio wants state governments to call the shots. We'll talk about what he has proposed this week in a little bit. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Your reactions to what you heard from the president today. What do you think should the federal government do to fight poverty in the United States, or not do for that matter? 800-642-1234. John in Rhinelander has some thoughts on Promise Zones. We'll go to him now. John, hi, you're on the air.
Aren't these tax breaks targeted at certain areas just another form of trickle-down? It's a tax cut for business that's targeted at a certain area. We found out that the trickle-down stimulus doesn't really work. The better stimulus would be boosting minimum wage and, say, making the Social Security payments progressive so that people on the lower end of the scale didn't have to pay in as much for Social Security. That would, in effect, boost their hourly wages, too, and that's a direct stimulus to the economy. All that money is spent, and it's magnified through the economy. Much better stimulus than trickle-down.
John, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Ron? It's almost sort of a supply-side versus demand-side argument there.
Well, the minimum wage is the opposite of what the president is trying to do. He's trying to give incentives to employers to come to an area. If you have a higher minimum wage, that would make them less likely to come, and it would also impose costs upon them. So that's the opposite of what the president is trying to do. And Social Security, which is not in the president's proposal, but it's already progressive if you consider both the benefits and the taxes to pay for it. So we're already doing half of what the caller recommends, and the minimum wage is not part of this proposal for sure.
And I think when people talk about minimum wage, usually it's an all or nothing, either the entire state or, I guess, a national minimum wage, not targeting it in one community is – well, I guess there are living wage proposals in some cities. But
yes, and states have different minimum wages, and some cities have minimum wages. So it could be local. It could be state. It could be federal. The discussion now, of course, at the federal level is that there should be a new federal minimum wage of $10.10, I think, is the one that's being most discussed now. It's important to point out Americans should understand that we have a program at the federal level, and many states, including Wisconsin, also have. It's called the Earned Income Tax Credit. And what that does is it gives a wage subsidy, and so it has the same exact effect as a minimum wage. It gives a wage subsidy to low-income workers, mostly who have children. There's one for workers who don't have children, but it's very modest. And it can be up to $5,000. It was a crucial part of welfare reform because the idea in Wisconsin and all over the country was if moms went to work at low-wage jobs, they would get subsidies through food stamps, but most importantly, through their income tax credit. I think that's a much better way to boost the wages of low-income workers than to do it through the minimum wage, especially because it's, so to speak, socialized. It's paid for by taxes, which are very progressive. The upper 20% of taxpayers pay about 85% of the taxes, and that's a source of income to support these low-wage, low-income workers. So it's a much better approach.
Wanted to mention Senator Marco Rubio now. He was talking this week, a lot of people talking about poverty with the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty. His concept, something along these lines, streamline federal anti-poverty funding into one federal agency. That agency gives grants to states and lets states, innovate, figure out how they want to use this money to tackle poverty and be more responsive to their own particular regional needs. What do you think of that basic concept? Not very fleshed out yet, I don't think.
Yeah, I don't think it's very fleshed out either. But the basic idea, as you just stated it, I think is a good idea. You have to be very careful about accountability mechanisms because, we have corruption in states. States like Wisconsin have it. Terrific tradition of being innovative and trying new things and carefully evaluating and having accountability. But there are many states that, might be a little bit concerned about that. The other point about his proposal, though, is that he would try to separate aid for working families from aid for families that are not expected to work. And the states would run the aid for families that are not expected to work. Excuse me.
That's okay. I'll go to the phones now. We've got Mike in Cross Plains with us now. Mike, hi. You're on the air.
Hello. Here in Wisconsin, it seems that our governor has been somewhat disinclined to accept federal money based on principle. Would he also disincline? Do you think he would also disincline the federal money on these block grants rather than, say, Milwaukee was a promise zone? And that's my basic question. In a state like Wisconsin, where our governor seems philosophically against accepting federal money, how would that the block grants work for us? Thank you.
Mike, thanks for the call. Ron, what do you think? Would there be governors, perhaps like our own, who might not take the federal money?
No, I don't. I don't think any governors would do that. First of all, the money's already been spent in the states. So this is already existing funding, some of which already comes to the states, but they would get even more. And I don't see any prospect that any state would turn it down.
All right. We're talking to Ron Haskins of the Brookings Institution about federal anti-poverty efforts with President Obama's announcement of the first five promise zones. I'll remind you of those. They are San Antonio, Texas, Los Angeles, California, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, southeastern Kentucky, and the Choctaw Nation of Oklahoma. A lot of talk this week about poverty with the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty. So, Ron, if they came to you and said, set aside our promise zones, set aside what Marco Rubio had to say, what should be our first priority as we try to tackle poverty from the federal government? What would your first steps be?
I would want to try both of them. I think they both have at least some promise. I'm especially enticed by the Rubio proposal because I want to make a clear distinction between helping families that can work and do work and give them more incentive to work, which is part of his plan, from families that are not expected to work. I think we're not going to make good progress against poverty until we have more working families. That is really a key. We've had a long-term decline in men working. We've had an increase in women working, especially single women up until recently, but we haven't recovered from the recession yet, so there are fewer women who are working, single moms who are working. And unless they can work and we subsidize their income, which is part of the Rubio plan, they cannot get out of poverty. Most Americans don't understand this. You cannot get out of poverty by just taking welfare. you have to work, and then the public subsidizes your income, especially through the earned income tax credit, which is what Rubio would want to focus on.
And your main point was separating those two groups, those who can work and those who can't. There's been a concern with welfare, with anti-poverty programs over the years that you know, it's a disincentive to go to work if you are losing your benefits when you go from public assistance of some sort to working. Why would you go to work?
Yes, but I can tell you that really is a thing of the past. We have changed these welfare programs now so that even people who go to work get more money than if they were just on welfare if you combine it with their earnings. The earned income tax credit, for example, they cannot get while they're on welfare, and that could be as much as $5,000 per family, plus the child tax credit, same thing, $1,000 per child. So you could easily imagine a mom with two kids could get up to $7,000, and she wouldn't get a penny of that if she didn't work. So we really have created a system that already has strong incentives, and the Rubio proposal is to focus on that distinction even more and try to improve the wage supplements for workers even more, for example, by paying them. We now pay it only once a year and pay it more frequently, probably with each paycheck or once a month or something like that. As you pointed out before, these ideas are not fleshed out. We don't know the details. The details are crucial for every program like this. But there are possibilities here, and that's why I think we should try to move ahead with both of these programs.
And before I let you go, we've got 15 more promise zones to be announced over the next 3 years. If you had the opportunity, could you pick out a couple regions, a couple places in the country that might make promising additions to the promise zone concept?
Well, every state has areas that are in bad shape. I think I would focus it on areas that are having economic difficulty, and I would make sure that if there's any disproportionate focus here, it would be on inner city. I think the inner cities for a long time needed a lot more than we're able to do, and the poor are concentrated in inner cities. I mean, rural areas are an issue too, especially for a state like Wisconsin, but inner cities like Milwaukee have enormous problems, and enormous percentage of our poor people live there, and more to the point, their kids live there, and their schools are not very good. They often don't have good public services and so forth. So if anything, I would focus on inner cities.
Ron, thanks so much for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
That's Ron Haskins, Senior Fellow and Co-Director of the Center on Children and Families at the Brookings Institution.
Coming up, we'll talk to a guest who says being optimistic about our personal finances could have a downside.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, if exercise were a pill, people would buy it probably by the truckload. So why don't more of us take advantage of the health benefits of physical activity? We'll hear about the exercise cure coming up after 5.
First, according to a new survey, over half of us are feeling optimistic that our financial situations can improve in 2014. Good news, right? But our guest says there's a downside that a return of better times may lead us to repeat past mistakes.
Gail Cunningham joins us now. She's with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Gail, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. There should be an interesting conversation.
I think so. Well, let's start with this optimism. That sounds like a good thing, right? People are feeling optimistic?
Well, they certainly are to a degree. We've seen automobile vehicle sales tick up. There are some indications, though, that delinquencies over on the vehicle side are also on the upswing. So that's concerning. But it's time that people really take a hard look at their finances. They've scrimped and saved and cut back, and thank goodness they've paid down debt, too, for a good many years. So some of them are in pretty good shape. Those aren't the people I'm terribly worried about, although I will send them a word of caution. But there are certainly a lot of people in households across the country that are not in shape to begin spending again.
So people are feeling optimistic about finances, maybe because they've saved money, maybe because it's a new year and people are inclined to feel more optimistic and the economy shows signs of moving in the right direction for people. What is your fear here when people are experiencing this kind of financial optimism?
Well, in our recent poll, 56% of respondents indicated that they projected they would be in a better place financially at this same time next year. So that was a very strong response, tripling the next highest category, where only 18% of respondents thought that their situation would be about the same as last year. So there's a strong trend toward feeling like rosier days are ahead. And that's really good. And I like that. I like to hear it about people that maybe that financial monkey's off their back. They can breathe again. So in spite of it being a healthy sign, it's going to take more than hope and more than a New Year's resolution to make a financial success a reality. And what I'm afraid of is that people are falling into financial amnesia. That's what I'm calling the affliction of too quickly forgetting the financial mistakes and the financial pain of the past.
So what do we do to avoid financial amnesia? What do we do to stay on track and keep our finances moving in a good direction, reducing debt and saving?
Well, I always tell people to approach financial decisions with their head, not their heart. So one thing you need to do is face the financial facts and know where you stand. As they say, you can't know where you're going until you know where you are. So you need to start with a financial plan. And what better time of the year? We are at a time of new beginnings. So let's take a fresh look at our finances. And also, you're going to be pulling out all sorts of documents for your tax return. So take advantage of that and get your finances organized. You know, I don't care if people have a full-blown home office or if they have an accordion file. I want them to be able to put their fingers on their financial documents, their monthly bills, their bank statements, along with any investments that they have and their will and other medical directives, et cetera. That should be at their fingertips. You shouldn't have to dig for that. And while I'm on my soapbox, I'll say and let someone else know where those documents are too. So that's going to all get you in your financial ducks lined up, and you'll be in a better shape to make financial decisions.
How do we, when we look at our personal finances, get a sense for where the danger zones are, the places that we particularly need to put in a little work?
Well, I think, again, once you know who you owe and how much you owe them, basically I'm talking about laying out all of your financial obligations, current debt obligations on that proverbial kitchen table as a start, then that's going to be very eye-opening. You know, a lot of people absolutely dig their heels in and refuse to track their spending. Why? Because they know that if they see their spending staring back at them in black and white, it may suggest that they make some changes in their behavior, their spending patterns, and they're scared to do that. But, you know, we're all adults. If we're old enough to have money and owe money, make money and owe money, then we're old enough to treat it responsibly, and that starts with knowing where our hard-earned money goes. So I suggest that even though you can't predict the future, you can plan for it and you can prepare for it, and it all starts with knowing where your money goes. It's really a shame that we work so hard for our money and then we so frivolously spend it. I want people to spend their money mindfully, not mindlessly.
Now, I know you advocate a few different ways to save. One area I gather is for unexpected things that might come up. You know, your car breaks down. Another, though, is for longer term ups and actually mostly downs in the path. Let's say you're out of work for 6 months. You want people to have some savings for that. And then maybe for things that are fun, but we know about birthdays, trips, travel. How do we spend or how do we save for those different categories?
You know, people tell me all the time, Gail, I can't afford to save. And I tell them, you can't afford not to. And I apologize for any double negative I just used, but I think the audience gets the idea. The financial emergency is going to rear its ugly head at the most inopportune time. I like to see people save in categories. Now, everyone needs that rainy day fund, that emergency money. That's for the flat tire or the maintenance, you know, the plumbing need, et cetera. If you don't have a well-funded savings account for the unexpected emergency, then you're left with poor resolution options, such as taking money from a higher priority. Maybe you take your rent money. Maybe you take some money that should be going to utilities, et cetera. That starts a downward spiral there because the problem's only going to grow. You're going to rob Peter to pay Paul, and before you know it, Peter wants his money. Another option is that you borrow from friends or family. Well, at best, that's awkward to do. And another option is that you charge the emergency, and that usually is piling new money, new debt on top of existing obligations, again, adding to a burdensome debt load. So let's fix it. Let's start by saving 10% of every check. Sock that away into a savings account at the end of a year. You'll have a little more than a month's income, which should sustain you through most short-term emergencies. Now, here's a little trick I like for people to use. You know, they may be thinking, well, yeah, that's nice in theory, and that sounds really good, 10% of each paycheck to savings, but I can't really do that. Well, how about $10? Could you save $10 out of each spending category? Could you carve $10 off your grocery budget, off your clothes budget, off of each utility payment, et cetera? If you have 10 spending categories and you shave $10 off of each, you've got an extra $100 per month to put toward debt reduction. And guess what? You'll never feel it. You will absolutely never miss that money.
So basically you're saying we should kind of whittle it down until it gets to the amount that we can feel comfortable about, that it's something that, you know, we can swallow.
That's right. Find that money to put either into savings at 10 bucks out of each category, or pay down debt, or invest it. Whatever you want to do, it's your money. And one of the easy ways, I mean, everybody knows intuitively when money's tight that you need to tighten the budget belt, but they don't quite know how to do it, or it sounds too big. So I'm saying $10 doesn't sound too big to anyone, I hope. And just keep multiplying that over and over, and you will find hidden money in your budget to spend as you choose to spend it that's right for your family. Another thing I like people to do, as long as we're laying out all our bills on the kitchen table, is get a piece of paper and divide it into columns of who you owe,
mm-hmm.
how much you owe, what is that interest rate, and what does that interest rate translate to in a dollar amount? So if you're a numbers person, you're really going to want to jump in and do something about that high interest rate debt, because you know that that's really doing you the most harm. But that can be a very daunting exercise. You owe $5,000 at 19% interest. It's going to take a long time to pay that off. But if you're a numbers person, you get it, and you will be motivated by those small incremental changes in that balance.
I think a lot of people are motivated to pay down debt, but I mean, what about prioritizing the debt and then saving for the emergency cash? So you've got that in hand too. How do you do both those things at the same time?
Well, let me tell you one other little trick for the person who does not relate to long-term, dig into the APR debt that's so high. I say then those people need to start with the smallest debt and work up. And also, you mentioned rewards. I want people to reward themselves. But, you know, you think, well, Gail, you just said it's a $5,000 balance. It's a long time till I get my reward. No, I want you to set small incremental goals. When you have knocked out that first $500 of the $5,000 debt, 10% of any debt, first 10% that you pay off, you reward yourself and set that goal in advance. It may be that you get to go to a sporting event or a concert or eat at your favorite restaurant, whatever, but reward yourself, and then that motivates you to keep going. Now, you've asked the big question, should I pay down debt or should I save? You should do both. And it's really, I could make an argument on both sides. Financially, I could run the numbers for people and show you how much harm debt is doing you. But I also know how much financial distress can come from an emergency where you have no emergency.
And we've just got about 20 seconds left for that long answer.
Well, and I want to go back to my columns. That fourth column was the amount, the dollar amount of interest you're paying every month. That is eye-opening. That will motivate you to do something about your debt, because that money could be going into your pocket and you spending it as you wish were you not having to service debt with it.
Gail, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your wisdom as well.
Thank you for having me.
And that was Gail Cunningham with the National Foundation for Credit Counseling.
Coming up, exercise has a lot of proven benefits, so why don't more of us do it? Our guest will make the case that getting active can cure a lot, more than we expect, of what ails us. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.